We were talking about the degrees of multiplication of surface area in the small intestine to maximize the chance of both digestion and absorption. In other words, to get all the good stuff out of that luminal contents before it gets lost as feces. And what is the first level of increase in surface area? The circular folds, or the plici circularis. And so if you think about the small intestine having a diameter of about like this, those folds will be a circular fold, all, you know, that you can actually see as a ridge, kind of like the inside is corrugated. All right, that's somewhat of an increase in surface area. Then on the surface of each one of those folds, which is a major hill, has a bunch of villi on it. So these are villi that we're seeing here in the photograph and in the cartoon. So this is just a tiny little section of one circular fold. All right? In other words, the hill itself is full of little hills. Each individual villus is lined by epithelium, of course. And so these tiny pink ones are the individual cells. And each individual cell has little projections of itself that I was talking about. Those are the microvilli, which you barely see in here. And those are what give the appearance of fuzziness to the endothelial lining, which is why we call it the brush border. And so it's hills on hills on hills, really. And therefore a really drastic increase in surface area from what you would get if it were just a smooth epithelium. Now, what you see in the cartoon is that inside each villus is connective tissue, loose connective tissue mostly, but also vessels. Each villus features an artery, a capillary bed, and a vein, or I really should say an arteriole, a capillary bed, and a venule draining that capillary bed. But, well, those are part of the closed circulatory system, of course, right? The blood circulatory system. But you also have the green thing here, which is, notice, a blind-ended thing. What I call the blind end is really the beginning of it, though, right? That is a lymphatic vessel, like we've already talked about in the lymphatic system, except the lymphatic vessels that begin in these villi of the small intestine are specifically called lacteals. And why are they called lacteals? Anyone know? What about lact? Milk, right. Lactose is milk sugar. That's why it's called milk lactose. Lactation is milk production. Lacteals are so named because the lymph that collects in them looks milky. It doesn't look like lymph from the rest of the body. And that's because it's not just serum that has leaked out of the blood capillaries, like it is elsewhere, that gets collected in the lacteals. The lacteals are where the fatty acids that get digested in the lumen of the small intestine get absorbed. So, not all of the nutrients get put into the hepatic portal system. Recognize, by the way, that the venule, or the capillary that's in this villus, is part of the capillary bed that is capillary bed number one in the hepatic portal system, right? So things that have been broken down to such a small size, individual molecular subunits, like amino acids and whatnot, monosaccharides, those get finally absorbed through the cells of the epithelium lining these villi, and then they get put into the bloodstream, which means they're in that first capillary bed. They're going to eventually make it their way to the hepatic portal vein, which will enter the liver and then branch into smaller and smaller branches, right, until it gets to these lobules that I talked about in the liver. When it gets into those sinusoids of the lobules, that's the second capillary bed. That's where most of the nutrients go, directly into the bloodstream from the small intestine, but not the products of fat digestion, which are the majority of the dietary lipids. Instead, they go into lacteals of the lymphatic system. Now, they're eventually going to make it to the bloodstream, right? Because all lymph does. The lymph that's carrying these fatty acids from the fats that were digested in the alimentary canal will just become part of the general lymph, which is collecting the same way that we talked about before. It is getting into, going through nodes, lymph nodes, but also collecting into bigger and bigger lymphatic vessels until eventually it gets dumped where? Not in my body. That's just in your body. Right, into the subclavian veins. So, specifically which subclavian vein, if we're talking about the fats, the fatty acids. Which one drains most of the body? The left. Yeah, the right is just about this much, right? Everything else, which includes what's coming from my gut, will go into my left subclavian vein. But then it's part of the blood, so it gets sent all throughout the body anyway. It's just it doesn't go directly into the portal system like the other ones do. 26. Here we're looking at muscular movements that can occur in the small intestine. And the small intestine has chyme in it. Chyme is a mixture of food. I mean, by food, I mean stuff that you have eaten, but also stuff that has been added along the way, right? Because secretions have been added from the mouth onward. Secretions from the mouth, secretions from the stomach, secretions from the small intestine, those have been added from the pancreas and from the liver. They're all part of the chyme by this point as well. But also so are a lot of cells that just get sloughed off of your alimentary canal. Well, you get nutrition from them just like cells that you eat from some other organism. You eat yourself, basically, when you digest the cells that have been worn off of the epithelium that lines the alimentary canal when that chyme comes through. And also there's a bunch of bacteria in there that live there and reproduce in your small intestine continuously. But anyway, that's what the chyme is, a mixture of stuff. And that some of that chyme has been digested completely, meaning to the point that it's individual monomers that can actually be absorbed, and so absorption is taking place. But some of that chyme has not yet been completely digested chemically, which is why it needs to, well, for both digestion and for absorption, it needs to continuously be mixed. And so there's kind of a kneading action that takes place in the small intestine, because small intestine has muscles in it, right? Those muscles can contract, but what happens in what we call segmentation is that different parts of the overall length of the small intestine contract while other parts relax. And then the ones that contracted relax and other parts contract over and over. And that is literally like kneading something that would be in a tube. Kneading it with your hands, right? You would perform the same function. Well, when the muscular contraction occurs, that's going to force the chyme away from that point of compression in both directions. So segmentation is called that because it breaks this kind of tube of chyme into smaller chunks. But it importantly, it mixes everything in it and changes the part that is in direct contact with the epithelium compared to is deep in the pellet. So it moves everything around, also helped by the plici circularis, which are kind of helical. Gives everything a chance to be exposed directly to the epithelial surface. And that's important for both digestion and absorption. Of course, you have to be exposed to the epithelium to be absorbed through the epithelium, right? But remember I said that you also have to be exposed to the epithelium for that last part of chemical digestion. Because to break, for instance, a dipeptide, just two amino acids connected together into individual amino acids, that's not done by secreted enzymes that are in this mix. That's done by an enzyme that is actually connected to the epithelial plasma membrane. So those have to actually be put into physical contact with the wall of the inner lining of the small intestine in order for that last bit of digestion to occur, and then it can be absorbed. And so segmentation occurs in both directions. Things move back and forth, but as you, if you think about a stretched out small intestine, so it, left end and right end in this example, the frequency of the muscular contraction occurs a little faster at the proximal end toward the stomach than at the distal end. It's also happening periodically here, but just the period is longer. And so, yes, it does move back and forth, but overall it gets moved this way because this is the slower end. And so it gets eventually moved toward the large intestine. And by the time it gets there, the hope is that there's been enough mixing so that there's been total digestion of anything that you're able to digest chemically and absorption of all that stuff that is nutritive. What is left is called the residue because that's what residue means, right? Residue means the stuff that remains. It's residual. And that's what we call feces, the stuff that you can't digest and absorb. Everything else with water make up the feces. Oh, by the way, I didn't mention peristalsis. The difference between segmentation and peristalsis, and they both occur in the small intestine, is that segmentation is about mixing and kneading, and that's why it happens in both directions. But like I said, it's kind of an overall heads it toward the large intestine. Now and then, though, the small intestine will quit this segmentation routine and go to peristalsis instead, which is definitely a one-way thing, just like it is in your esophagus, right? It's a wave of contraction that starts at the proximal end, and the wave moves toward the distal end. And so that's not about mixing it anymore. That's about getting this bolus or glob of chyme from one end of the small intestine to the other. We can see what I was talking about before with respect to the need for there to be direct contact between nearly but impartially digested materials in contact with the epithelium of the small intestine. That is called contact digestion for that reason. Contact digestion does not involve secreted enzymes. It involves membrane-bound enzymes. So they are permanently part of the plasma membrane of the cells that make up the inner lining. And you can see the microvilli on these. The microvilli not only allows for a greater absorption surface, which itself requires proteins to do the absorption, but it also allows you to have a more enzymes, which are also membrane-bound proteins. They're just doing a different job compared to the ones that transport things inward. So we've already talked about the fact that pancreatic amylase is one of the components of pancreatic juice, right? Amylase is responsible for what? What does amyl mean? No. Proteins get digested by peptidases or proteases, either one you can call them. Starch, right. Remember that amylose is starch, and therefore the enzyme that breaks down starch is called amylase. So the pancreatic amylase gets exposed. It is secreted, right? It's coming from the pancreas, secreted as part of the pancreatic juice into the lumen of the small intestine, specifically the duodenum first, but it'll be part of that chyme now. And so it gets exposed to starches, starch molecules that are in the originally the food you ate. That's going to break it down chemically. It's chemical digestion that amylose performs, but it doesn't complete the digestion. It doesn't break starch into nothing but monomers. Now, starch is, speaking of monomers, starch is nothing but glucose. So it's the only kind of monomer used when you make a starch molecule. It's just glucose after glucose, end to end. But what I'm saying is that amylase does not break it down into individual glucoses. It just breaks it down into smaller chains of glucose. And since they're smaller than the full-blown starch, which is a polysaccharide, we call those oligosaccharides. All right? Now, maltose is what kind of sugar? It is, I mean, in terms of size. Anyone know? It's a disaccharide, yes. And so if maltose is a product of digestion of starch, and it's a disaccharide, what is in it? What's it made up of? Glucose and what else? Glucose, right. Starch is nothing but glucose. So maltose is just two glucoses stuck together. That's what maltose is. A disaccharide of glucose. Well, you know, amylase works kind of randomly. It's going to break it into smaller chunks. Some of those will be maltose. Every once in a while, there might even be a free glucose. But most of them will be maltose or bigger. And the bigger ones we call oligosaccharides, meaning more than just two monomers. Those then need the help of one of these membrane-bound enzymes to do the final bit of digesting them into individual glucoses, which are then ready to be absorbed. And so in the plasma membrane, membranes of these many cells making up the endothelial lining are enzymes to do that job. Notice maltase, dextranase, glucoamylase, these are all enzymes that can break these either di- or oligosaccharides down into individual glucoses. And glucose is by far the most prominent sugar monosaccharide that's contained in the food you eat. It's just in the form of other sugars mostly. It's not pure glucose when you eat it. It's glucose as part of starches mostly. There are other monosaccharides that get absorbed as well, but glucose is the most numerous in your diet. Now to 28, and this shows you how the absorption actually occurs. On the right, notice that that's the lumen. So this is the space in which the chyme is. The pink ones are the cells themselves of the endothelial lining. And then the core of the villus, that's not empty, of course. That's interstitial fluid, really, right? So where is the basal lateral side of the endothelium? Yes, the side that's by the villus itself. This is it's not shown here, but there's a basal lamina, right? That holds all these cells in place. This is the free or apical surface because it's unattached. So absorption occurs at the apical surface to get digested monomers into the cell. They travel through the cell and then get passed through the plasma membrane on the basal lateral surface to actually get into the core of the villus, where they will eventually make their way into the bloodstream at the capillary that's in that villus. Well, if they do that, they're traveling by the cellular or transcellular route, right? Notice, though, that some things also travel via the paracellular route, meaning they go into the spaces between the epithelial cells. And that's because even though these are tight junctions represented here by the black lines, they're not as tight junctions are elsewhere. So water is able to get through these tight junctions, and certain solutes are able to follow in what we call solvent drag. We already talked about this before, right, in the kidney. It's the same thing that's happening here, really. But the things that are being transported via the transcellular route, or just the cellular route, if you prefer, are doing so mostly because of sodium transport. So this red one on the basolateral side, what is that? It's what? It's a sodium-potassium exchange pump, like you have working in all your cells, right? Remember, that was responsible for moving things around in the kidney as well. Here it's doing work for secondary active transport. It maintains the gradient with respect to sodium. It's continuously pumping sodium out of the cell through the basolateral edge. That means sodium is going to be scarce inside the cell. Therefore, sodium will easily diffuse from the lumen, where the chyme is, into the cell, right? Because on the other side, you're pumping it away. Well, that's where these blue and green things come into play on the apical surface. These are sodium symporters that, well, at least the blue ones are. The sodium symporters in blue here are called symports because they're moving two things in the same direction at the same time, right? So sodium is coming in by diffusion because the pump on the other side is keeping sodium concentration low in the cell. And other things get dragged along for the ride, like glucose, for instance. So that's a sodium-glucose co-transporter, or symport. There are other ones as well, other nutrients that get moved by the same way, by this sodium-coupled mechanism. By the way, and some things just diffuse in, like fructose, through their own specific transporter, membrane-bound transporter. But there are all kinds of different monosaccharides, right, that you could design in a laboratory or make in a laboratory. But by far, the most abundant ones in food that you eat are glucose, fructose, and galactose, as you see here. For instance, table sugar is really what? It's a disaccharide that's made of what? Glucose and fructose stuck together. So it's most of the sugars that you have in, even though there's all kinds of different sugars, they're mostly combinations of glucose, fructose, or galactose. So that's why those three are shown here. And by the way, the fructose, notice, once it's in the cell, can be transformed into glucose. So at the basolateral side, which is where you need to get it, continue it all the way through the cell and then put it eventually into the bloodstream, but first put it into the interstitial fluid, that's where you have transporters that will carry these sugars through the membrane. Now, the colors here are not really representing what specifically is being transported. It's really referring to the mechanism of action, as you see on the key. So green is representing facilitated diffusion, meaning these things are going down their gradient, so it's passive transport, but they can't just go directly through the membrane. They need the help of a membrane-bound protein, which is exactly what facilitated diffusion is. Symport, like I said, is an example of secondary active transport. The thing that's being diffused, which is sodium, is dragging something along for the ride. So two things are being transported at the same time. And then antiport means that they're moving in opposite directions. Okay, but that's also active in this case, because even though the ATP is not shown, it takes ATP to continuously operate that sodium-potassium pump. Okay, now to 29. Well, we just talked about sugars a little bit. Let's talk about proteins. And starting out in the mouth, remember I said that if you pass out with beef jerky in your mouth, it's going to still be beef jerky whenever you wake up. That's because the mouth doesn't really help you with chemical digestion of protein. If you chew it, that's mechanical digestion. It will break the food into smaller chunks, but that doesn't break the molecules. The chunks still are much bigger than the molecules, so each smaller chunk that you chew it up into still has huge molecules in it that don't get chemically digested because saliva doesn't contain any proteases, right? So it's not until it gets to the stomach that proteins start to get chemically digested, and even there, not really so much. The acidity of the stomach helps to denature the proteins, which is different from digestion, right? Denaturation simply means that they lose their shape. They become more of a linear strand of amino acids rather than folded up into some three-dimensional shape. But what else does the acid do in the stomach, which is important for digestion? Yes, it converts what into what? What is the stomach enzyme that will eventually chemically digest the proteins themselves? What's that called? Pepsin. No, pepsin. That's the enzyme. But remember, that doesn't work in the cell that produces. Well, the cell doesn't produce pepsin. The cell instead produces pepsinogen, which gets secreted from the cell into the stomach lumen, away from the cell, safely away from the cell. And then the acidity, which comes from the parietal cells producing the hydrochloric acid, that converts pepsinogen into pepsin. And then pepsin is the active enzyme that starts breaking these proteins into smaller chunks. Any given protein is a polypeptide, right? Or a set of polypeptides. Each polypeptide is a long string of amino acids. Chemical digestion of a protein consists of breaking the peptide bonds between adjacent amino acids within a polypeptide. So this will break it into smaller chunks, but they're still linear arrangement of amino acids, just like it was for starch. So the pepsin breaks it into things that we call either shorter polypeptides than they were originally, or if they get very short but still multiple amino acids, we call those oligopeptides. All right, that happens in the stomach. So the chyme that gets delivered to the small intestine from the stomach still has polypeptides and oligopeptides in it. Those get broken into even smaller oligopeptides by the pancreatic enzymes we already talked about, right? Trypsin, chymotrypsin, and carboxypeptidase. Well, remember, those also start out as proenzymes and get converted into the active enzyme, in this case not by acid, but by the action of enzymes in the duodenum and trypsin itself. Once you have the action of all those, then what you have left are really just very small lengths of amino acids, dipeptides mostly, and that's when contact digestion will bring that home and break them into individual amino acids. So aminopeptidase and dipeptidase and carboxypeptidase, those are the ones that can finish the job. Carboxypeptidase takes a single amino acid off of the length of an oligopeptide at the carboxyl end of it. A polypeptide has a carboxyl end at one end and an amino end at the other end, just like each individual amino acid does. So carboxypeptidase takes one amino acid off of the carboxyl end. Aminopeptidase takes one off the other end, the amino end. And dipeptidase will take, you know, with the action of both of these, what you have left really are just dipeptides. And dipeptidase will then break that into the two amino acids it's made out of. So overall, you have nothing but amino acids at that point. And that is what actually gets absorbed into your bloodstream through the endothelial lining. So notice that you don't put proteins into your body, right? You build your proteins starting from the drawing board, which is your genes and your DNA, for how to build those. You build them out of amino acids that you got from other organisms by eating them, But their protein doesn't enter your body unless you inject it into your veins, which you shouldn't do. You digest it into the building blocks, and then you use those building blocks to build your own proteins. 30 shows you, meanwhile, what's happening with the lipids. So we talked about sugars or polysaccharides and polypeptides. Here we're looking at lipids. And like I said, by far most of the lipids in your diet are fats, specifically triglycerides or triacylglycerols. They take a little bit different route. Remember, they enter the lacteal, but it's not as simple as just getting absorbed into the lacteal. It actually is quite a bit more complex than what happens with the other nutrient classes. So a fat globule is, first of all, emulsified by bile. That's what the detergent aspect of bile does. Detergents are able to emulsify a nonpolar lipid big droplet into smaller droplets. And doing that is not really chemical digestion. It's just emulsification that aids in digestion because it makes a lot more surface area for that overall collection of lipids. And surface area is important because that exposes it to enzymes. All right, so bile contains what are called either bile acids or bile salts. They're the same thing, but different books call them different things. Which, along with lecithin, which is a lipid that's also in bile, these things package fat globules, once they're emulsified into smaller droplets, into what we see in the cartoon in the upper right. All right, now each fat globule coated with its lecithin and bile salts is now a little packet that in which digestion of those fats can occur. And a fat, that's the easiest of the three names you can call a fat to remember or to spell, but it doesn't really tell you about it. The word triglyceride tells you really what it is made of. A fat is a glycerol molecule connected to three different fatty acids. So there are three fatty acid tails hooked onto one glycerol molecule to make up a fat. Therefore, when you break that down, you dismantle it. Well, usually what happens is that the two outer fatty acids get cleaved off, and so they are called free fatty acids at that point because they're not connected to anything else. The middle one is usually still connected. It might also be cleaved off, but it usually isn't. And so you have two free fatty acids, and you have a monoglyceride, which is that same glycerol, but just one fatty acid connected to it. All right? Those are digestion products. Now, those get packaged into what are called micelles. Micelles are kind of like vesicles, except a vesicle has a double phospholipid bilayer, just like the plasma membrane. It's a bilayer. A micelle is a monolayer of lipids. But they form little packets, and so each micelle has a lipid core, and it's coated with bile acids. All right, now that occurs in the lumen, all of that processing. Now it comes time to absorb them on the bottom. And at the brush border, these little micelles get absorbed into the cell, spilling their contents, which are the free fatty acids and the monoglycerides, into that cell itself, in the cytoplasm of the cell. Within that cell, then, seems like we're going backwards, but what happens is that those building blocks, the free fatty acids and the monoglycerides, get recombined into triglycerides again. So you broke them down once just to get them into the cell. Now you're building them back up inside the cell, the fats. And it might not be the same fatty acids that it was with it originally, but you make them into fats again, okay? So these are triglycerides. Triglycerides, along with phospholipids, which are also coming from your diet because you eat cells, and cells' plasma membranes are made up of phospholipids, and cholesterol, that is partially taken in if you eat animals, but it's also made by you, and it's part of this mix because you are an animal and make your own cholesterol. Those get packaged into a new thing, which is called a chylomicron. All right? Now, notice the chylo part of chylomicron. That chyl part is also a word that we use to describe the lymph that is going to be collected in the lacteal, which is where this thing is headed. That specific lymph is called chyl. Until it gets mixed with the other lymph, then it's just lymph. But it's the chyl is the specific kind of lymph that makes it look milky. And so the chyl is in the lacteal, all right? But the reason it looks milky is because of these chylomicrons containing all these fats in it. Okay, that's what makes it look milky. Well, for the moment, the chylomicron, which has just been created, is still inside the cell. Chylomicrons, though, can be packaged into secretory vesicles by the Golgi apparatus, okay, within the cell. And once you have something in a vesicle, it can be exocytosed, just like we were talking about for ADH, right? Even though that exocytosis didn't expel anything from the cell, exocytosis can do that. Just like for a neurotransmitter, remember, that was also exocytotic. So these chylomicrons get released from the vesicles that contain them when the vesicles exocytose, merge with the plasma membrane, and let out their contents. These little dots now are the chylomicrons. Those contain fats. The fats are too big to get into the blood capillaries, which is why they don't get put into the portal system. But remember that lymphatic vessels, lymphatic capillaries in general, and lacteals specifically here, because they are just examples of lymphatic capillaries, are much leakier. They have these flaps that can easily open up. And that's why the chylomicrons, and therefore the fats, get put into the lymph system first. They're just too big for the blood capillaries. Well, 31 actually doesn't have any new information. It's just what we've been talking about, but it's all put into one slide. I don't think I really need to go through this again because I just did, but this is a good thing to study as a whole summary page because it tracks everything from the mouth to the small intestine where it gets absorbed for the three major nutrient classes, carbohydrates, proteins, and fats. It's review, though, so I'm not going to bother saying everything that's on there. Let's go then to 32. So now we've completed the absorption job, and so those nutrients are finally in the body at this point. And the stuff that hasn't been allowed into the body and is still in the alimentary canal, the residue, is all the stuff that didn't get absorbed, and that's what we call the feces. That gets sent to the next part in line in the alimentary canal, which is the large intestine. And what were the three parts of the small intestine in order? The duodenum first, directly from the stomach, pretty short length, and then what? And then the jejunum, which is where most of the digestion and absorption takes place. And then what? And then the ileum, which finishes up the job. By the time you get to the end of the ileum, you are at the very beginning of the large intestine, and remember where the two come together is called the ileocecal valve, because the very first part of the large intestine is called the cecum, which is a large pouch-like part that we see right here. So there's the ileocecal valve. Like I said before, that has a sphincter. But when appropriate, the chyme that is in the small intestine passes through the ileocecal valve when the sphincter relaxes. It's now officially feces now that it's in the large intestine, but it's in the cecum first. And hanging off of the cecum is the vermiform appendix. It's called an appendix because it's appended on, just like It's called that in a book, something that you stick on the end of the book is the appendix. It's called vermiform appendix because vermiform just means worm-shaped. Yeah. In a normal person, everything is situated like you see in this figure. So the cecum is in the lower right quadrant of the abdominal cavity. And then the flow of stuff, the flow of feces in this case, is going to go upward first in what we call the ascending colon. Then it takes a drastic sharp turn to go horizontally. And that sharp turn is called a flexure. And so that's called the right colic flexure because another name for the large intestine is the colon. So colic means of the colon. Another name, by the way, for the right colic flexure is the hepatic flexure because that's where the liver is. Okay? That gives rise then to the horizontal part, which is the transverse colon. And then another sharp turn downward at what you would expect to be called the left colic flexure. That has another name as well. What would that be? No, because it's not exactly, I mean, there is a kidney right there, but there's a kidney on both sides. What do we have on this left side only? Tucked up right under the diaphragm. Spleen. So the left colic flexure can also be called the splenic flexure. And that gives rise to the descending colon. And then it takes turns at the bottom here, but they're just not as drastic. So the descending colon gives rise to what's called the sigmoid colon, meaning shaped like a sigma, but that's just a Greek S, right? So it makes an S-shaped curve until it gets to the midline, because the descending colon is on the left side. The sigmoid colon brings it to the midline, and then heads it straight down. The part that is straight and right on the midline is called the rectum, and that's why it's called the rectum. That means straight, like in rectangle. All right? It narrows, the rectum then narrows and becomes the anal canal, which is guarded by both an internal and an external sphincter. So there's an internal anal sphincter and an external anal sphincter, which you can see in cross-section here. All right, so the rectum ends where it narrows. That's the anal canal. The anus itself, which means ring, is really just the outer ring. Well, the rectum is the final storage place for the feces right before defecation. Defecation is going to deliver it from the rectum through the anal canal and out of the body. Well, strictly speaking, it's already outside the body, like I've said, but you know what I mean. So in the final slide, 33, we can see this happening. Defecation, that is. Just like micturition was defined as the intermittent voiding of the urinary bladder, intermittent meaning now and then, largely up to you, right? Same is true with defecation. It's the intermittent voiding of the colon, largely up to you. But both of them are up to a degree, right? You can only hold either one so long. Well, here you're seeing the wiring involved in the defecation reflex. So when the buildup of feces in the rectum becomes such that it starts stretching the narrowing at the beginning of the anal canal, that's going to send signals via mechanoreceptors, stretch receptors, to the spinal cord. That's the green arrows here. These sensory fibers are responding to the stretch by stretch receptors. They're going to send a signal to the small intestine, spinal cord as part of a reflex, the defecation reflex. And remember, reflexes don't have to involve the brain. They just go to the nearest central nervous system part, which in this case is the spinal cord, and then send information, motor information, back. That doesn't mean the brain doesn't know about it, though, right? Because the neuron that brings the information to the spinal cord can branch and then send information up the spinal cord to the brain, which allows you to realize that you're starting to stretch the anal canal and it might be time to think about defecation. The reflex, though, is trying to take over without your control. And so the output of the reflex arc, the downward red arrows, are sending information to the internal anal sphincter, which is an involuntary ring of muscle, relaxing that internal anal sphincter so that the feces can be removed. But remember, there's two sphincters. There's also an external anal sphincter, and that one is under your conscious control. So by sending information to the brain that the stretching has occurred, you can, at least for a while, say, okay, but not yet. I'm going to keep the external anal sphincter closed long enough until I can make it somewhere where it's more convenient to let go. And that brings us to the end.